From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. We're broadcasting this week from a seasonally decorated New York City, as cold as it is pretty.
In your view, God's law is that homosexuality is a sin. In your view, does God's law prescribe an appropriate punishment for that sin?
God's law is always clear that the wages of sin is death.
Earlier this month, Rachel Maddow confronted Ugandan Member of Parliament David Bahati on her television show. Bahati introduced what has come to be known as the Kill the Gays Bill. And those of you who listen to State of Belief Radio regularly are familiar with the story of how the politically active American fundamentalist right has played a leading role in encouraging and funding this initiative that promises penalties of lengthy imprisonment and even execution. Pastor Joseph Tolton of New York's Rehoboth Temple traveled to Uganda earlier this year to get a first-hand look at the situation, and he's going to be joining us on today's show.
Yeah, don't miss the method. I don't rap songs. I rap Christian ethics. I pray what I say.
In the beginning, my coach was like, "You're telling me that you're going to wear all of that when you play."
Very
it was
good.
The image that I was creating,
right?
That
so
Muslim women, although they wear a hijab, meaning the veil, they don't need to seclude themselves.
This week, the PBS television series Independent Lens is presenting a fascinating special about seven young people, Catholics, Protestants, Muslims, and Jews, who are training for the ministry. The piece is called The Calling. And it premieres Monday and Tuesday on many public TV stations. We're going to meet director and executive producer Danny Alpert and talk to several of the young people featured in the program. I hope you've had a chance to hear our interview with Jeff Charlotte, whose latest two books explore the potentially bloody impact fundamentalist leaders in the U.S. have had on a distant African nation. The interview is available on the archive section of our website, but in addition to the dispassionate coverage a journalist brings to a story such as this one, there is the personal side that deserves to be addressed. That's why I'm so pleased to welcome to the studio Reverend Joseph Tolton. Also with us is Bishop Christopher Senyanyo, who led the Anglican Diocese of Western Uganda from 1974 to 1998. After retirement, he started a family counseling center and was eventually expelled from his church for refusing to condemn some of his clients. And we're also joined by Frank Mugisha, Executive Director of Sexual Minorities of Uganda. Friends, we've got the primary voices of this story right here in this studio. Reverend Tolton, thanks for being with us on State of Belief.
It's wonderful to be with you. Thank you for the invitation.
I guess I want to begin. I know that you went to Uganda, and I want to talk about that, but I want to begin with why you went. And of particular interest to people who listen to State of Belief Radio is the intrusion of Western political and religious leaders into the lawmaking process of another country. Now, let me just ask first, how overt is that involvement?
The involvement of the religious right of this country is remarkably overt. You've had several evangelists throughout 2008 visit Uganda and actually make presentations to the parliament, from Rick Warren to Don Shamir to Scott Lively. They were bold in their presentations. These were not underground meetings. These were meetings that are well documented. So their trips left a lasting impression, and particularly Scott Lively. You can actually hear the echo of the language from his book, The Gay Swastika. You can hear that language in the Bahati Bill.
Were they invited there, or was it more like God told us to come and so here we are?
I think they'd probably answer yes to both of those questions. but the connection of the family, this secret organization that's housed at C Street, I believe, which Jeff Charlotte has written lots about, has an international purview. And so there are people in the Ugandan parliament who are members of the family. So they've been connected for years. So I think on a lot of levels, this meeting was the result of work that they've been doing for quite quite some time around how is it that the Ugandan society can be a society where God's law is imposed as the civil law.
Yeah. I know that our listeners will probably be more familiar with Rick Warren's name
yes.
than the other two names. Does this mean that Rick Warren has a relationship with the family at C Street as well?
He absolutely has a relationship with the family at C Street. And beyond that, he has a very close and personal relationship with President Museveni's wife. Uh-huh. And that is also very, very, very well documented as well.
So you wanted to go to Uganda. Why?
As a little boy, I remember very well being raised by my mother and my grandmother. My mother was a nurse, but she was very ill and therefore couldn't work. And my grandmother was retired. So we were raised on public assistance, on welfare. And I remember us watching programs like the PTL program with Jim and Tammy Baker.
Mm-hmm.
And although we were very poor, living in Harlem in a tenement, my mom would find nickels and dimes to put together to give to them. And as a child, I remember thinking, why is it that their concern for black people is only brought to bear when they want to send money to Africa, but they jump over communities like Southeast Harlem and Watts and South Chicago and are able to see the plight of Africans, but have no interest in the plight of African Americans. I have always been extremely aware of the racism that is in the DNA of the Christian right. And so as an out and openly gay man of faith who is African American, when this issue found its way across my desk, it's one that arrested my attention because I saw it as an extension of the religious rights racism. For years, they have pit the gay community against the black community. They did it with Proposition 8 in California. They did it in the 2004 election in the state of Ohio. And now the landscape is global as opposed to domestic, and they're doing it again in Uganda. And I think it's important that we connect those dots.
So did you hear about this from Uganda or from the States or from both at the same time? Where did you learn it?
I honestly learned about the issue watching Rachel Maddow, as I'm sure many of us did, because she was one of the reporters who
yes.
certainly first broke the story.
Right.
And I was obviously intrigued by the story. I didn't realize, obviously, at that point that I'd have this level of involvement. But
so what did you learn on the trip to Uganda?
Absolutely. Well, I learned one, that every African American needs to take an inverse passage to really, I think, find their own sense of their place in the world. That's one thing that I learned. What I learned beyond that is that the LGBT community on the ground in Uganda has had a fantastic response to this issue. They taught me what courage was all about. Bahati thought that he was going to fracture the LGBT community. But what happened was the Bahati bill overreached. And because it overreached and had so many intrusions on broader human rights, the progressive community, for the first time, which had had a blind spot in Uganda on the LGBT issue, those fighting for immigrants' rights and the rights of workers and the rights of women, did not have the LGBT issue on their radar screen. This forced them to not only consider the LGBT issue, but to embrace it and to weave it into the issues that the progressive coalition fights for in Uganda. So Bahati actually took the LGBT community and connected it with a broader community when that was not his intention, ironically.
So did the resistance to the Bahati legislation come out of the churches?
By no means. It came out of local community-based organizations that are grassroots organizations doing work on the ground as it relates to the fostering of progressive values. Those interested in women's rights, the rights of immigrants, mm-hmm. Because, of course, with the issues in the Congo and Somalia, there are lots of immigrants in Uganda. Those that are very much so fighting for the rights of women who are raising orphans and housing orphans, that coalition became connected to the LGBT coalition. And together, there was tremendous internal pressure and pushback against the bill.
So were the churches in Uganda more where the visitors from America were?
Yes. There's no question that the Church of Uganda, the Anglican Communion there, which is the dominant church, is extraordinarily conservative. And they have been out in front and very supportive of this, to some degree, supportive of Africa being a place where people who are gay or lesbian have no human rights. The independent Pentecostal churches have been the ones who've taken it further, who've actually partnered with Bahati and have actually kind of given him a spiritual home, as it were, and a home for this anti-gay legislation.
Okay, one more question here. In December of 2010, where is that situation right now?
The elections are happening now, and because the elections are happening, the bill is on the back burner. So over the last 3 or 4 months, we've had a little bit of a window to do some strategic planning to further push back against the bill. We understand that the bill will probably be reintroduced sometime in February. Our thought is that the bill is going to take out the death penalty and life in prison as the punishment for being gay or being caught in a gay act, and that the promotion of homosexuality will become illegal, that that's what they're going to push for, therefore threatening every activist with being in prison within 24 hours of the bill passing.
Pastor Tolton, this is staggering
news.
And sad for the church, sad for Uganda. And I have to say, it makes me angry at what's going on within the religious right in our country. Well, I want to pull in some of the friends that are with you in this work so that we can hear some of their perspective as well.
Absolutely.
We've got to take a quick break, but we'll continue the conversation in just a couple of minutes, looking at the potentially deadly intersection of religion and politics in Uganda and the influence of American political and faith leaders on the situation there. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. Welcome back, everyone, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. Pastor Tolton, I wish that our listeners could see the people who are in the room. They can't do that. Well, why don't you tell us what friends you have with you in the room?
Absolutely. We are proud to have with us today Bishop Christopher Sinyonjo, who is from Uganda. Bishop Sinyonjo is a retired Anglican bishop who has had a renowned career there in Uganda and a real sensitivity to doing work with people on the margin, and has been probably the most outspoken cleric, the most outspoken straight advocate and ally of the LGBT community there on the ground in Uganda. And his center is St. Paul's Equality and Reconciliation Center. We're also joined by Frank Mugisha. He's the executive director of SMUG, Sexual Minorities Uganda. It is an umbrella organization for all of the LGBT organizations on the ground there. He's led the LGBT community. And we're joined by Reverend Canon Albert Ogle of San Diego, California. He was my traveling companion to Uganda, and we are doing this work together.
Well, let me start with Mr. Mugisha, that you're from Uganda. It would seem to me that the very existence of an organization like Sexual Minorities of Uganda would be incredibly dangerous.
Sexual Minorities in Uganda became visible in 2007 when we held a press conference in the city and spent 45 days going on radio stations and TV stations telling people that we are LGBTI people and we want to be accepted and live like anyone else. But that time we received a lot of resistance from churches who organized and formed the Interfaith Rainbow Coalition Against Homosexuality. And they came in big numbers. They started asking our own communities, our own mothers, our own parents to fight us and stop us and stop accepting us.
What made you do it?
Well, at that moment, what was happening in Uganda is that the media was outing people who did not want to be outed. And we were calling on the media and telling them, if you want to write about homosexuality, come and ask us, who are visible and who you can see. If you want to write about stories of LGBTI people, ask us, and we are here. We are going to give you the right information instead of writing wrong information and outing people who don't want to be out.
Let me say a word to Bishop Sinyoyo. I'm interested, Bishop, were you surprised by the extremely negative reaction by the churches, or did you expect that?
I was surprised because the churches, I believe, are for the oppressed people. But then the churches stood against me because I was on the side of the oppressed, rejected. I was surprised.
Do you see a way that things can change within the churches in Uganda?
I think there is a way, and that's why I'm standing on the side to try and bring about a change.
In relation to the Bahati Bill particularly, will church leaders ever speak out in opposition to that bill?
I have not seen it. They have not spoken. I don't think they will speak out, no.
And what will you do with silent churches and the passion that's in your heart?
What I will do is to go knocking, still knocking at the door, because I think one time they will open.
You think at one time it finally will open?
Yes, I do. I have a hope.
That's great. You couldn't keep going if you didn't.
No.
This is not just right on the subject, but I know you have retired. I don't imagine you expected your retirement to be this difficult.
No, I didn't at all. I expected, but because I know and I knew from the beginning that this is what was needed. People who came to me were suffering, and they needed somebody to speak out.
Bishop, I want you to answer this question, and then I want Frank Magisha to answer the question as well. What will it take to change the attitudes and environment in the churches of Uganda regarding the LGBT community? Will it be a study of Scripture? Will it be what they see happening in terms of injustice on the human rights front? Will it be because of family members? What will bring about that change?
What will bring about, first of all, the change is the solidarity of other people with us who know that LGBT is not right. And then education. I believe there's a lot of education needed for people to understand that LGBT is not a sin in the way these people are talking about, and study the Bible with more understanding. Because I see people are opposing LGBT because they really don't know that LGBT is just one of the phenomenon of the human sexuality.
Mr. Magisha, will you also answer that? What do you think? What will bring about a major change in the lives of those people, whether in the church or not in the church in Uganda, regarding their negativity and demonization of LGBT people?
I think what we need is a lot of education. We need dialogue to talk about the issue, because the churches are not giving us an avenue to speak out. So we need a lot of progressive churches that can come and dialogue with the other churches so that they can listen to each other and create an avenue of speaking about the issue. And then they'll understand, because some of them, they say they are ignorant. They are using their ignorance to stigmatize people and create all this homophobia. So we need the progressive churches to come and, I would say, teach them how to read the Bible correctly.
Now, I want to be sure I understood what you said, that you need progressive churches to help facilitate those conversations.
Yes.
Can they be churches from outside Uganda, or do they have to be churches in Uganda?
Churches within Uganda, but supported by churches from all over the world that are progressive.
Yes. Reverend Canon Ogle, let me ask you, you were along on this trip. As you watched what was unfolding in front of you, what came to mind as a way your own communion could help?
It's interesting because I worked in Uganda about half my time from 1991 to 1997. So I saw a huge change in the Church of Uganda that I remembered. I worked with Archbishop Okoth, who was very inclusive. We had 12 full-time workers working in the Church of Uganda to prevent the spread of AIDS. And the bishop, we gave out millions of condoms at that time. Abstinence, be careful, condoms only. And what I saw around 1996-97, the Christian right, you began to see changes in policy around things like AIDS, and abstinence only began to be taught. So I think our communion is really helpful. We believe in an inclusive church. We also believe in the value of human rights. And I think you have people like David Bahati who says in public that homosexuals do not have human rights. Homosexuality is not a human right. And the church needs to speak out against this.
Reverend, let me ask you one other question. And I want to actually ask all of you this same question. Unfortunately, we can't give you access to talking to the church in Uganda or to religious people in Uganda. We can give you some avenue for speaking to religious community in the United States. If you have 1 minute to talk to the religious community in the United States about this situation, what do you want to say to them?
While I was in Uganda, there was a press story about a pastor from Georgia, Atlanta. He came over, is opening 50 specific churches that are anti-gay. His name is Carl Jenkins. I discovered that Carl has a very dark past. He tried to set fire to his lover and her children, spent 5 years in jail, was fined $100,000. In my denomination, I would have been unfrocked for that. The churches in this country, we need to be much more careful about what we're sending out as a message. The government needs to be much more careful about how money that's going through churches is being used to really make it very difficult for minority communities in places like Uganda just to live. And I think if churches could see the impact of this hatred, they would really bring pressure on their pastors to stop this.
Mr. Bagushi, what would you say in a minute statement to the religious community here in the United States?
First of all, I'd like to ask the religious community in the United States to support the progressive movements in Africa that are preaching love and give them moral support and courage to continue doing the work. I would also like to ask churches here to follow up the work that is being done by other churches outside America. Some of this work is hateful work, to try and follow up and hold them accountable.
Bishop Sinyanyo, what would you say to the religious community in America?
I would like to say that we should stop these people who are trying to plant the seed of hatred. Hatred kills, but love brings life. And our lives are in danger in Uganda. If this hatred continues, it might lead even to genocide, which we had seen in Rwanda. So let us love one another as we are asked by our Lord. Let us, as we love ourselves.
Boy, that is a good one, because I don't see any love anywhere in what we're talking about today. Reverend Tolton, you went, you saw, you've come back. I know you're a thoughtful person. What's next?
I think next is developing a coordinated strategy on the ground here for us to respond to this issue, given the fact that it's American evangelicals who are responsible for planting the seeds. And I think that there are a few things we need to do. One is we need to hold the religious right accountable for what they've done. I think we need to speak to the black church and be very clear that the time has come to stop allowing the religious right to pit African Americans against gay Americans, and that the black church's silence means that they are complicit. The black church has been a place where we have seen the advancement of civil rights, and now there's another opportunity for civil rights to again be advanced in the pulpits of the black church. And then I would say to those who are in the middle who are questioning, come out wherever you are, and stand up with us. Don't wait until the situation gets worse in Uganda, but come out now and stand up for what you know in your hearts are right.
That's Reverend Joseph Tolton, pastor of Rehoboth Temple here in New York City. Gentlemen, with Reverend, I want to thank all of you for joining us today and giving us a better understanding of this nothing but tragic situation in Uganda. You have given us an insight. You have probably made some other people as angry as I am to hear that that's being done in the name of religion. And you probably also have inspired some others to get involved. I very much hope that's the case. We really appreciate you being here at State of Belief Radio, and we will stay in touch with you so we can continue to follow this story.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up next, The Calling, a new four-hour documentary exploring religious vocations today from a multi-faith, first-person perspective. This is State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. Monday and Tuesday, December 20th and 21st, the public television series Independent Lens will premiere a four-hour examination of religious vocations in America today. The show is called The Calling. Now, that terminology comes from primarily the Jewish and Christian traditions in which people speak of being called by God, chosen for a specific vocation, impelled, compelled by the divine impulse in making a decision about how to spend their life. The Calling. And we're going to be talking to director and executive producer Danny Alpert in just a few minutes. But first, I want to talk to a couple of the seven young people whose journey toward religious leadership is profiled in the program. And fortunately, I have on the line with me right now Rob Penny. Rob is from Samoa. He's studying at the Haggard School of Theology at Azusa Pacific University. Rob, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. It's an honor to be on.
Now, I understand that you're working at a Presbyterian church in Los Angeles, and you're also a Christian rapper, which means that you must have made John Calvin turn over in his grave.
Yeah. During the time of the film, I was serving as the young adult youth minister at a Presbyterian church, and yes, I was big into hip hop ministry, Christian hip hop ministry. So quite an interesting marriage.
Well, listen, in talking about your calling, how did your family take that? How did your friends take that? Did they understand what you meant when you were talking about being called to ministry?
Well, it was quite a transition for my parents, more so my mom, when I shared with her that I was actually going to go into ministry as opposed to going to college, getting a degree in business and pursuing my baseball career and trying to make it to the major leagues to make millions and millions of dollars. Because coming from Samoa, you know, money isn't that great. So the goal for me to go to college was to get a great education in business, do well in baseball, make loads of money, and then come back. So when I shared that I'm not going to come home for the summer, I'm actually going to go and do ministry in inner city Detroit, and I'm not going to play baseball, it was quite a shock. It was quite a shock for my parents. My father knew that, you know, I was kind of a weird child, you know, very introspective, but also had a super spiritual side. He said, you know, go ahead, do what you need to do wherever you have peace, however you feel you need to go out and be you. We'll support you. So once I got that, it felt good to have their support. But it was kind of a shock and a new type of approach for my mom in terms of trying to think about, you know, where my life is going to be. And, you know, parents want the best for their kids.
Sure. When the interviewers started talking with you about this special series on television, what were they particularly interested in knowing about you?
At the time, it was when I was very, very busy with the hip-hop ministry. I was traveling the country, doing a lot of youth events, speaking engagements, and putting out records. But I was also going through college, going through grad school, trying to work on my master's. So I think what drew them was me going into prisons, me mentoring inner-city youth, and then also working at a predominantly Caucasian church. Mm-hmm. So I think that dynamic was interesting to them. And then, you know, life life happened, and my narrative changed because of you know, just life and my father. So, and they captured that whole time period for my personal transition and questioning and all that stuff after my father's passing.
Well, what do you see as the role of a religious leader in American politics? Is there a role for a religious leader in American politics?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think religious leaders play a major role, and more so on the education piece, because in religion we teach and we preach and study a lot about ethics and morals, but more so in embracing differences. I think that's a very important message for this time, especially with economy, politics throughout the world. Being able to embrace our differences, understanding that we're all each unique, you know, in our own right. Yet we can still get along and still accept your belief and accept your message. It may not be a particular for us or for me in my culture and in my area, but that doesn't mean we can't get along.
Rob,
having a discussion is massive.
Rob, can you give me 15 seconds of Christian rap?
Okay, sure.
Give it to
sure,
me.
Sure, sure. It's saving faith. When I choose Christ, it ain't about saving face because I'm persecuted. I walk the narrow gates down the valley is the devil where his arrows wait, and he can shoot me. I'm already covered in blood. Don't confuse me. I'm in your face all because of love.
thanks, Rob. Rob Penny, one of the seven young people profiled in the TV special, The Calling. We appreciate having you on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. God bless you guys.
I'm pleased that we're now joined by another one of the seven young people profiled in the TV special, The Calling, Tahara Ahmad. She's a young Muslim scholar, school teacher, student in Hartford Seminary's Muslim Chaplaincy Program. Tahara is also a department head of Islamic Studies at the Islamic Foundation School in Illinois. Tahara Ahmad, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Tell me what you mean by calling.
A realization of my purpose in life.
Is there divine motivation by that or divine inspiration in that?
Absolutely. I would say that, you know, in the Muslim tradition, we don't have you know, at least there's a similitude, but I wouldn't say that we have an exact reference point to say that, you know, God has called me to do this, meaning we don't say that, well, we've seen a vision or we've heard God's voice. You may not encounter a Muslim saying such a thing. However, we will use this understanding that we've been inspired through the divine to take upon a task, and that could be the task of motherhood. It could be of being a good citizen. It could, you know, being a good partner to someone in life, or to serve your fellow human being and all of God's creation.
Tahara, I know that there are variations of philosophy, theology, culture among Muslims, as among all other people in the world's religions. Not everybody in the Muslim community would be comfortable with you, a woman, saying that you had been called by God or inspired by God to do a certain work.
Well, wow, that's also an interesting question. You've got all your questions lined up here. Well, you know, the Muslim tradition over centuries, over 1,400 years and now close to 1,500 years, has had, you know, the presence of women in religious leadership. And that's just been a fact throughout our, you know, historical evidence. In the past, I would say 200 years, there's been a relook at what does it mean to have the presence of Muslim women in religious leadership. So one may have contention with this idea that, well, what does that mean? What does it mean to have a female Muslim chaplain serve a Muslim congregation. And I'm sure that over time, various institutions will develop that understanding. And it really, we're pioneers in the field right now, many of us. And there's only a handful of us across the nation serving, right, serving both actually really secular institutions. I don't know of any Muslim female chaplains at a masjid or a mosque as of yet. So there may be a concern of what that means and what will that mean as far as providing services or as far as providing mental health counseling.
Mm-hmm.
But it's certainly a good question because it, you know, it really raises concern about the development of the field, particularly for Muslim women.
And Tahira, it seems to me you have that challenge because of gender. Do you feel there's also a special challenge for religious leaders in your tradition because of the current climate in parts of the world?
Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah. In other words, we're experiencing in this nation an outburst of Islamophobia. We have suspicions that have no basis in reality. Do you also feel you have some special challenges because of the controversy surrounding the very identity of Muslims at other places in the world?
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's all, you know, we've part of this, you know, new phase of Islamophobia is, as you know, both you and I know, has a lot to do with the current political, you know, climate of the United States. A female in the role really symbolizes many different, you know, realities.
Mm-hmm.
One is that a male can be in this position and you may not even know that he's a Muslim, right, because
right,
of the way he's dressed, whereas a female will be, you know, normatively, she'll have a head covering or something that directly, as imagery, as far as imagery goes, there is a direct connection to the Muslim world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And for some, that, again, may raise a sense of sensitivity or, you know, xenophobic tendencies, I don't know. But certainly I think in other ways, though, while for some, while it may raise a concern because it reminds them of certain imagery that they associate with oppression or of subjugation, on the other hand, I think having female chaplains really serves to build bonds on campus.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there's a level of understanding that I think women have to offer, a level of compassion that women can offer in terms of building interfaith bonds and, you know, breaking the barriers of stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's, you know, I can see that the role may actually serve in many ways to alleviate some of the challenges that we currently face.
Great. Tahira, thank you for being with us on State of Belief today. Tahira Ahmad is a young Muslim scholar. She now is the associate chaplain at Northwestern University. She's a young Muslim scholar, school teacher, student in Hartford Seminary's Muslim Chaplaincy Program. Tahira is also a department head of Islamic Studies at the Islamic Foundation School in Illinois. The Calling. It premieres on PBS Monday and Tuesday, December 20th and 21st. Right after this break, we're going to talk to the program's director and executive producer, Danny Alpert. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is State of Belief Radio. Welcome back, everybody, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. With us now is Danny Alpert, director and executive producer of the new PBS special, The Calling. Danny, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
What was the inspiration behind this project?
Well, I think that my inspiration for producing The Calling is on two levels. In terms of my personal history, I was brought up in an observant Jewish home, and as a young man did consider entering the rabbinate, becoming a rabbi. Mm-hmm. And I woke up one night in the middle of the night with sitting up before my eyes had even opened, realizing that that wasn't the path for me, that that wasn't my calling. Mm-hmm. I preferred not to be such a public figure. I prefer to be behind the camera. But I always certainly was left with that what if question in my mind that lingered throughout. And as I moved on past that point and became a student of all the Abrahamic faiths, I was and I lived abroad for many years. When I moved back to the United States, I was really struck with the by the tension between modernity and faith in this country, and was really looking for a way to explore those themes. And along the way, on other projects, met a number of other clergy students, heard their stories, and all of a sudden the light bulb went off, and I said, oh, this is a great way, through personal stories, mm-hmm. Of really people who are trying to live their faith and form their leadership in the United States to explore those things.
Danny, I'm curious, in the process of making the film, was there a particularly memorable moment or story that has stayed with you?
Well, there were so many memorable moments. I think, the beauty of this type of filmmaking, of the verite or observational filmmaking that follows characters, is that they really come to trust the directors. And I want to make clear that there were four other directors besides myself on this project. And they really came to trust the directors who were, following them and opened them their lives up to them in really intimate ways. And so I think, you think about the death of Rob Penny's father and his crisis of faith in that moment and following. That was really moving to me. I know that for me personally, I directed one of the Catholic stories of Father Stephen Gomez, and was with him at a time in his formation when he was working as a chaplain at Children's Hospital in Dallas, and working with a family whose child was critically injured in a car accident, and going through with him and working through and hearing from him as he was working through his own emotions and around as a human being and as an emerging priest about what it meant to have a four-year-old boy on the verge of death and have his parents choose to take him off life support, and what his role was as a priest in those delicate and emotional moments of grief, that has definitely been something that's stuck with me to this day through his experience.
In dealing with all of these diverse faith journeys, did you notice a common theme in them?
Well, I think, we did not set out to make a film that showed, that was look how similar all we all are kind of a film. I think that what struck me most in terms of commonalities was some characteristics of this new generation of emerging religious leaders, at least this slice of them. I think that there is a difference from their predecessors in their willingness to conform. They want to, and they certainly do, embrace and live their life of faith fully, and they don't make compromise there. But at the same time, they're equally not willing to compromise on their identity as modern American young people. Mm-hmm. They want to get their tattoo, or they want to listen to their hip-hop music. They want to reach people equally through jokes as well as preaching. And that was really something that I thought was striking to me, was this, they want to have their cake and eat it too, and they're going to work to make it happen.
It's a fascinating project, and I want to thank you for talking to us about it today. Danny Alpert is the series director and executive producer of the new PBS special, The Calling. It's going to premiere Monday and Tuesday, December 20th and 21st. Danny, thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, and all the best.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Visit us online, though, at stateofbelief.com. You can find out more about the show, listen to the show's archives, and sign up for our podcast. Tell us what you like about the program and what you'd like to hear in the future. We want to know your thoughts. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including our listener line. Did you write it down? 202-238-3291. We want you to tell a friend about our show or several friends and encourage them to listen to the show also. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. One thing about the coming year is already clear. The cause of religious liberty is going to need more support than ever. We will do our part, but we need your help. Join us today. Become a member. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. We'll be right back here on State of Belief Radio next week. Please be sure to join us Christmas weekend for more stories from the intersection of religion and politics. I think I may just have a few special words for you as well. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was. Yes, he was.